Hi, welcome to the Do Lectures ... podcast with me, Gav Thompson. Thank you so much for joining us. Today we talk to Andy Middleton. Andy is one of the founding partners of the Do Lectures. Over his 62 years on this planet, he has done so much stuff, I can't even begin to summarise it here. He is a storyteller, he's a campaigner, he's an activist, he's invented his own sport, and he's just an all-round force of nature, generally focusing on nature. So please sit back, grab a coffee, put your feet up, and listen to Andy Middleton's ... Welcome to the ... Do Lectures podcast, Andy Middleton.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here and see your smiling face on the screen, which I know people won't appreciate, but it means a lot to me here and now.
Andy, you are such an integral part of the Do Lectures, the history. You're a founding partner. You're a limb of the Do Lectures, if not a more vital organ. So we definitely need to cover all that off. I think because you're so intrinsic to the history and the fabric of Do, I'm kind of going to slightly break the rules a bit here. As our listeners know, the normal convention with is ... is we sort of go back to someone's Do Lecture, whenever it was, and we ask them to sort of both summarise that Do Lecture and then build on the ... What's happened? What's the ellipsis that's happened since that story? I'm not going to do that with you because I think there's just too much to kind of get into, and I don't want to do it in that kind of narrative form. But I definitely want to hear a bit more about you because I've met you a few times. We've been to the Do a few times. I've sort of been following you, stalking you around the internet, whatever. And I know one thing about your early life, which is amazing, but I don't really know the whole story. So why don't you give us a feeling of where you got to in, you know, in your early part of your life?
I was born in St David's on the west coast of Wales, the one of three kids, children to a GP, doctor. I had amazing parents. My dad's still alive now. He's 99 years old. And they gave me amazing freedom to just go off and explore. As soon as I was kind of old enough to be relatively safe, I had the freedom to just go off and explore the incredible coastline backyard that we lived in. And it took me a while to realize it, but I certainly noticed it later in life that I was standing on the shoulders of two sets of parents and grandparents who were activists. My grandmother on my maternal side was an activist in the health sector in Yorkshire. She was like one of the first women members of health boards in Yorkshire in the 1960s. My grandfather, her husband, was a campaigner for students' rights in journalism. Got an OBE for that, campaigning to give young people voices. And then my dad, as a rural doctor in this kind of, back at when he moved to St David's in the 1950s, what tourism wasn't a thing. But he ended up being a GP who also had a side project that was being an emergency doctor for the RAF. And so he flew nearly 100 rescue missions off the coast of Ireland and all around the Western Approaches, but also in his own way, really tried to change the way that the health system responded to safety and emergencies. So I guess I just grew up with the wallpaper stories around people trying to make change happen, who were just normal things to do. And I didn't appreciate at the time how much that must have percolated into my consciousness.
Which it clearly has, as we're going to come on to discuss. I guess the thing I observed when I was kind of thinking about you in advance of this chat was where you were born, right? St David's being this amazing, and I want you to bring it to life in a second and describe what it is really like, but I just was wondering what you would be like had you not been born in this, in the amazing environment that you were born in. Because so much of what I hear you talk about is so linked to the environment with a big E and a little E and your place and space. I wonder what would happen if you had been born and brought up in Lambeth, whether that would have taken you down a different path.
I think that's such a good question. I generally speaking, hold the view in life that we make our own luck. But the one piece of luck that I'm eternally grateful for is the fortune of being born where I was in this tiniest of cities, the smallest city in Britain, in a national park surrounded by coastline. And it's informed, you know, everything I've done. It's always been my home. I've lived here for 62 years. I've travelled, but this has always been like where I'm from and where I've come back to, and I don't imagine living anywhere else. And that would have been an absurd idea to me as a teenager that I would spend my whole life here. I guess the really interesting thing that I've noticed in the time that I've been running TYF, you know, 3.5 decades, is that places like St. David's have gone from being the end of the world, which people used to say, what's it like living at the end of the world? Whereas now, whether it's the end or the start of the world depends on which way you're facing. And for me, this is about the start of the world now for so many conversations, so many pathways of possibility that people come here for, to spend time thinking as well as playing and reimagining what's possible. And so for me, it's like an absolute pleasure to be somewhere now by accident initially and then by design later, that an amazing group of people just holiday here, travel here. And I've spent my whole summer going on walks with amazing people around our coastline, discussing some of the biggest topics that I can imagine, or sea kayaking, going for sea kayaking meetings whilst discussing fixing the world food system. And that's about as good as life gets, really.
Why don't you try and summarize for someone that's just joined us and doesn't know who you are and doesn't know about TOAF and doesn't know all the stuff you do. Try and just give us a summary for someone who's never heard of you. How do you currently fill your life?
Cool. So what I do now, as what I spend my days doing, is connecting people to people and connecting people to ideas and then helping people make sure that the ideas that they've got are bold enough to meet the challenges of our time. And I connect people to ideas and I recalibrate ideas to make sure they've got enough of what I would call appropriate ambition. Does the ambition of their idea meet the conditions in which they're coming from, where they're in? And I guess the context for that is that, and this is part of that story, is that I grew up on this coastline learning to surf at 5 years old. You know, I've got my first kayak when I was 12 or 13. And I learned the outdoors by accident because it was just around me. And my first business was a surf school, which I ran for a couple of years. That morphed into an adventure business. We had a couple of adventure hotels. We've taken 200,000 people to play nature in that time. I invented the sport of coasteering.
Not many people get to invent a sport. Tell us about coasteering.
We grew up on this rocky coastline where on the times when there's no surf, nothing else to do, we'd go out to headlands and leap off the headlands into the water, as anyone would do if they live on the coast. I just happened to have been around at the time when wetsuits became available for everyone at a cost that was affordable. I'd done life-saving, I'd done rescue, I'd done whitewater kayaking and climbing. And I also explored a huge amount of the coastline as a teenager, just around the cliffs and caves. And when we had the kit to start taking friends out to do it, you know, climbing around the cliffs, falling in when you can't climb, jumping off, dodging the waves, it put friends' eyes on storks. We realized that we had a product that we could sell. People have always been climbing around the cliffs since they were kids, and just we happened to be the first people who turned it into something that people could learn how to do within a kind of professional framework. And the bit that connects to this bigger picture piece I found interesting, didn't spot for years, is that being allowed to continually take people out to dangerous places safely means that the guides who work with TYF need to be as prepared as they can be for every risk that they can imagine encountering. And if they do that and they can spot the risks properly, they've got the right physical kit, they've got the right mindset and the right training, they can cope with pretty much anything that comes their way. When I started working in business and government, I realized that's not how they talked about risk at all. Because government uses phrases like, well, Gav, we'd love to do your idea, but mate, we're risk averse. And it's kind of go, horseshit, you know nothing about risk. Because actually, when organizations say we're risk averse, it usually means that they're change averse or action averse. I spend a lot of my time now helping people match the real risk of not changing to the quality of the ambition they set about the changes that they would make if they couldn't fail and knew what was coming.
Which is, again, what an amazing ambition. What a valued skill, particularly in increasingly risk-averse society, I think.
And I guess for me, you know, when I first met David and Claire, you know, when I first heard the jungle drums, you know, the drums beat to say, oh, there's some interesting people moved west. You know, and we kind of got to know each other. For me, at the time, the world of design and comms was like a completely alien world. I'd grew up in the outdoors, been doing quite a lot of work in consulting, but training and development particularly. The world of design was relatively alien, and David and Claire and the teams they brought together taught me a huge amount and gave me a different language to explain the challenges that I'd been working with and really helped me to get my head around what the best questions are that we need to be asking. And that helped me help others make that change.
There is a little bit of a tension in your Do lecture. It was quite, I find quite interesting, which I experienced a little bit when I was did mine the year before, which is for some reason, well, it's fairly obvious because of the world that David and Claire come from. A lot of the people in the room are to some degree part of the problem, right? They're marketeers, they're flogging stuff, they are driving unnecessary consumption. I always find that just that interesting tension because I'm both part of the Do community, but I'm also, I work in marketing. I'm very guilty of persuading people to buy unnecessary crap. I find that inbuilt tension with the Do community kind of interesting and sort of unresolved. It comes up a bit in your original talk. How have you reconciled those two slightly potentially conflicting objectives?
I think they're definitely conflicting. The statement, I suppose, that feels most relevant is that one that we've all heard in the comms world around culture eats strategy for breakfast. And culture is clearly all, not all about, but it's largely about how we communicate the messages about the things that matter. And the one thing that the environmental movement, broadly speaking, has been rubbish at is communicating stories in a way that make people want to listen.
Couldn't agree more.
And for me, the magic that I really sensed to do from the very earliest days, and this goes back to Little Big Voice, which is like the prototype event that happened 18 months before the first Do, was this idea that if we could bring the talent of the people who work in the comm space and the insights they have around behavior and connection and messaging with the things that needs to be talked about, we could create some incredibly powerful processes to release change happening. And that's been my, I couldn't let go of that when I first came across it. And it's informed a huge amount of what I've worked on since.
Yeah, and look, I mean, that's exactly it. You've got a big, chewy problem called the world, and you have a lot of ignorance, apathy, you know, fake news, whatever you want to call it. And the way to address those things as a business problem, marketing problem, is to get some smart marketeers, comms people, advertisers on the case, which I think is why the Do is so special. But there's definitely a tension. And I when I first came in 2011, and I kind of rocked up, and I was... Yeah, I mean, I turned up in a Porsche, for example. That's not a good start. so I wasn't helping myself. And then when I was sort of poncing around, I definitely got a lot of "What are you doing here?" which was a fair question. And then David, because David's brilliant, as you may remember, said, because on the last night I said, "Mate, I'm not sure. I loved being here, and it's been life changing, but I feel a bit out of place." And that's when he said, "Come back next year and do a talk about how you can actually work in the corporate world and not be a complete arsehole and actually being part of a force for good and change for good within corporate life is part of the solution, right? You can't be us and them. You know, everyone has to work together on solving these problems." So hence I did my talk about, you know, the pirate inside. We still didn't resolve the Porsche issue, but that's a conversation for another day. Just tell us the story about how you kind of first actually got involved with Do and Little Big Voice and how did it all start?
When I started TYF, you know, this adventure business, education, consulting business, it, you know, today employs about 40 people or so. And when starting a business down here, trying to do anything different was a bit like running a business in the Galapagos Islands. So it felt like, you know, you can develop into your own species.
Yeah.
And no one will know.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, businesses trying to do things differently down here at the time were really unusual. Now in St. David's, it's like the normal thing. We've got a bug farm, we've got an insect protein business, we've got a really wild emporium, we've got loads of cool stuff. Now, but at the time, we were the single species in the Galapagos that were different. So when David and Claire moved down, the jungle bells, so to speak, the jungle drums, you know, hey, something interesting's come down. And we immediately connected, I guess, over a need to help communities thrive and to bring different messages in. And from the very first time that Little Big Voice ran, meeting a whole bunch of interesting people from that design and comms world, gave me that first sliver of an insight into a different way of communicating this stuff. And what I noticed was that, you know, over the years, as I kind of emceed and introduced speakers and blah, 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 I would be talking about this idea, you know, Wales is this tiny country with 3 million population. Surely it could become a prototype lab for sustainable change. You know, the fact that it hasn't happened at scale is an example of how shit I am sometimes at getting things to happen. And at the same time, you know, we've got an active conversation. There was sparked by that belief of bringing people together from different spaces. that we could run a program that would take 100,000 people in public sector through a program of well-being and connection and revitalizing their spirit, using a lot of the techniques and tools that are shared by Do speakers over the years. And I think when you listen to the Do talks, there's not many stories being told. They're the same stories. They're the same stories about persistence and courage and failure and spirit and focus. But when you hear them told by different people, from farmers to fashion to wrestlers to comms people, you realize the cadence of those stories, the patterns are the same. And I think for me, that's what reinforces their relevance. But also, what struck me really strongly was that most of the people I worked with in the health sector and education and social services had never heard most of this stuff. And working out, how do we get those messages into millions more homes at the speed of light? Because that's the speed we need to move at.
Yeah, and look, that's always been my frustration with it, I guess, in the from a brand point of view. I think the Do Lectures as a brand has amazing consideration, right? There's not a single person who knows about it, doesn't love it, but it's got incredibly low awareness. And that's a problem, which is why I'm doing the podcast, which we end up, of course, getting to more people than you would physically, but we've got a long, long, long way to go. And it is frustrating because the message is so powerful and it works so well. I mean, for those listeners who haven't had the pleasure, going to a Do lecture in real life in Cardigan is a life-changing experience. There's no question about that. I've been lucky enough to go to big TED Globals around the world back when TED Global was a real thing. And I would trade all the TED Globals I've been to one Do lecture. It's so amazing.
And you know the power of that, Gavin. I mean, I think it might have been at the last time you ran Do, you know, I can't wait to get around those smoky fires again. But I was chatting with David and Mark Saylor, and we were sitting around, and Carlo, and we were sitting around the bonfire at the back end of the day, reflecting on that kind of lovely feeling of being kind of tired, yet energy is still buzzing, but getting lower, and talking about the conversations we'd had with people. And one of the guys was reflecting on the fact that, you know, they talked to someone who'd come up and said, the Do lecture saved my life. You know, and they were at the kind of the end of their road before coming down to Do and actually realizing there was a different way to tell their story and a different place to find energy from. And I think we never know about most of the differences we make, but from the few that you hear, you know that they touches lives. And that, you know, the Do lectures holds a really special place for a lot of people about being, it's the space where compressed energy gets released. Many people who come down know they want to make change in their life, but not quite sure where to or how. And for me, that, you know, the image that popped into my mind was like the power that's released when an arrow gets released from a taut bow. And that kind of the quivering of that arrow as it finds its path is like the experience that people go through in 2 or 3 days at Do, when so many beliefs about your own inadequacy or the fact you can't do it because you've got no resources or you can't do it because no one's on your side yet get challenged to their core, which kind of brings you back down to saying, do I really care about this thing I want to do? And only, of course, only you or me or the individual can ever answer that question. But I think it helps people get on to that trajectory. And of course, once the bow is released and it's on target, its energy will take it there. And Do is that safe space for helping find that direction for people. And I think that's what's so powerful.
You are listening to the Do Lectures .. podcast with Gav Thompson.
One of the things about your story, which I just wanted to get you to share, is, look, we've acknowledged that your parents and your grandparents were iconoclasts in their own right, were doing amazing things and were activists. And we've also acknowledged that you being born in St. David's is a big part of your story. There was something that you touched on in your first Do lecture about your time working in a gold mine in Australia, which I can't help but think has to have had some impact on you. Can you just tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. So when I was, I did a degree at Sheffield University in kind of geography and geology with like a pretty major sideline in surfing, whitewater kayaking, climbing, which wasn't part of my degree, but took quite a lot of my time, and ended up in Perth in Western Australia, got a job in a job centre in a gold mine, as you do. And you don't get them in the job centre in Hertford West or Swansea in a gold mine, but ended up working in this gold mine that was 250 miles from the nearest house, in the great sandy desert where the temperature was like 53 in the shade and the hottest days. I mean, in a community of 300 people in the middle of nowhere, my job was to find gold mines. So it's a pretty shit environmental credential if you want to kind of make a negative impact. Is go and find somewhere, find an insignificant valuable metal that people can justify digging up millions of tons of rock to go and find, then put back in different holes in the ground. What really struck me there was the sanctity of pristine nature. You know, I'd be driving in places and I could see where one person had driven one vehicle 15 years ago, because it would change the landscape forever and change what grew there, change the surface. And it really struck me as how sacred this space was. And it helped to really cement that belief in the importance of changing what we did. And I think it helped to set my space. And again, who knows what would happen if I'd stayed there. But coming back here was a big part of that. And I guess it's the odd experiences. It's the kind of the potpourri of experiences of working as a bin man, as a surfing instructor, as a climbing instructor, blah, 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 that allow me to do what I do now, which is translating stories across genres, but more importantly, across disciplines. So I've been a board member of government environmental organizations. I've been a board member of third sector conservation organizations. I've run six businesses, whatever. And I can talk to corporates or SMEs or to governments. And that piece has been so vital, I guess, in the work that one of the biggest projects I'm working on now, which is called Wales Transition Lab. And this is directly informed by Do, and this idea of setting Wales up to be the world's test lab for sustainability. And so with colleagues, we brought together leaders from 35 different sectors who've never spoken together before. Despite the fact that health is in crisis, farmers produce, technically they produce crops, but they don't. They also clearly produce food. But the farming community has never spoken to the health boards before, despite the fact that the health boards are losing 25, the six, seven health boards in Wales are losing 25,000 quid a day in terms of cash flow benefits on type 2 diabetes. We've never spoken together before. The third sector can't talk to the farmers because they sometimes criticize them for pollution incidents. The big food businesses who are represented by the branding agencies make out that they're doing all this stuff for health, but never do anything. And, you know, they'll say, you know, we're all over number one health, but they've never spoken to health professionals. We created a safe space working with UCL's Climate Action Unit in London to bring people from completely different areas of work who've theoretically got a shared interest to find out what's the most that could be delivered in the overlap between nature, well-being and food. And if everyone took the brakes off their imagination and their capability, how much difference could we make, how quickly, by really exploring what's in that overlap? And that's taking quite a lot of my time, like right now.
That notion, I've done it a bit in my career, of bringing people from completely disparate industries, but they are related with a common cause, kind of stick them in a room and get them to just talk and share each other's problems. And so how would you solve the problem if you were suddenly a farmer? How would you solve the problem if you were a food business? Or you see it. I mean, amazing, you're doing this. You just see these little moments of inspiration where I gave up the poncy name for it called Brandology, where I would sort of get very strange people in a room. I get a lighting designer from Hollywood with a A&E first responder, with a maitre d', with a NCG owner, and you just put them in a room and just go, right, let's try and solve a problem. Now, I was doing it for the man, so I was trying to solve business problems. But actually, you're trying to solve one of the largest problems facing humanity. At least people are going to come, they're going to turn up and lean in, right?
Well, no, absolutely. And I guess one of the things, I suppose, that do really help me understand was the whole process within kind of design thinking about the art of asking really good questions, which I wasn't unfamiliar with as a business consultant, but design puts in a different angle on that. When this piece that's recurring sort of motif for me is about saying, if you knew what was coming around climate and nature emergencies, what would you set out to do if you knew you couldn't fail? Which means you have to start with the end point rather than where you're at now. And do is a huge role in helping me kind of find the voice and the confidence to ask that in a way that encourages people to ask it. And one of the consequences of that has been, for instance, in the world of education, there's an amazing teacher who's become a good friend, who's runs a school in Barry down in South Wales. She's got a scheme called Big Box Boyd, sort of Wenglish big food box. So it's a converted shipping container in two schoolyards that takes surplus food from supermarkets through Fair Share, so the parents who can't afford food can get high-quality food for free. The kids all get taught how to grow vegetables, and they get given a whole set of real-world challenges set by local businesses about how to fix the food system. And our goal, and, you know, Do's got a huge role in this, our goal is to get every child in our country food literate within 5 years. So that in 5 years' time, every 11-year-old will have been through a school system of knowing the relationship between what you put in your mouth, what's to your body, your brain, nature, and your community, and having experienced that with their own ears and eyes and senses because they've been part of playing with it. And that ambition to create big changes without having a fucking clue how to get the answer is actually what Do's helped me to find. And it's only, as you can appreciate, by bringing together the Scouts and the Brownies and Duke of Edinburgh and retailers in Iceland and Co-op and God knows who, can you ever sort a problem that's so complex? And only by letting go of control can together you have a chance of delivering something so epic.
One of the things I've always struggled in my career, frankly, in my life, is I'm quite good at the idea generation. I'm quite a creative person. I'm not necessarily the right guy to go and make it happen or deliver on the detail and the microness of stuff. My observation with you, Andy, is you have a very, very capable brain and you're involved in lots and lots of things. How do you sort of, when you've got all those different people in a room who are, you're trying to solve massive world problems, but everyone does have their own agenda, how do you sort of force everyone to kind of make progress and sort of be expedient and get on with it rather than, I don't know, I find I would struggle to actually do that and not get sort of frustrated and go, start banging the table, go, come on guys, this is fucking important. How do you manage that?
I can really relate to that. And I suppose if I look back, you know, that so standing on the stage or sitting on the hay bales at the Do lectures, talking about this idea of prototyping Wales as a country for sustainability, and I'd be kind of going, why the fuck is no one interested in doing something at scale? And, you know, and I knew, Dave, they're not interested because I wasn't good enough at telling that story. That's the only reason they weren't interested. And this is not about other people not wanting to listen, but it being me not being able to communicate that in a way that made sense. As you know, when you've pitched something maybe 1,000 times, the story starts to get clearer, but we have to pitch hundreds and hundreds of times for the clarity of that to start to appear out of the kind of the murk. And the other piece that I guess is really struck me is that if we get good at telling our story, you know, we get invited to tell it to more people through, you know, events and conferences and stuff. And if you do that enough times, the right people will make themselves present and go, hey, I loved what you said. And the difference now, I think, is that when I'm telling those stories, I'm with people who can go, yeah, don't worry, I've got this. I'm going to talk to the chair of my organization that's got 10,000 employees tomorrow about this, or I'm going to talk to the minister about this next week or whatever. So it's having big ideas scare people who need detailed solutions first. But people who are charged with creating massive scale organizational change in corporate or public sector worlds have not got time for people who are over-enthusiastic about micro detailed changes. And so rarely, Gab, I think, do people come to them and go, okay, we could take every single primary school kid through a program of change in 5 years like this and not need to be the organization that's got, and I want to do it all. This is about me, me, me. And I think for me, letting go of the need to be doing any of the delivery, happy to help if I can, but it's not about TYF. Just say, let's just get this fucking thing to happen. And then not worry about who picks it up has been massively, massively freeing because it allows me to talk about bigger ideas without worrying about, but what if they don't include
me? Yeah, and that's, again, that's such a great, you've got to kind of know what your skill is and what your role is in the process. And it sounds like your role is the connector and the storyteller and the narrator. And then you have to let people get on with what they're very good at, which is can be the delivery and the planning. And you've got to stick to your kind of strength, your superpower. What's the thing that you're most optimistic about? Somewhere on your journey, the problem's probably getting a bit worse, I guess. I don't know, maybe they're getting better. I sense you're a naturally optimistic kind of a chap because you wouldn't do what you do otherwise, but what are you most optimistic about in what you're doing for the future?
I think that's such a great question. Wales has got this amazing piece of sustainability legislation, which only applies to public sector. The UN talk about it as being the best in the world. You know, it's certainly really good compared to most. And it's called the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. And there's a requirement in this act for organizations to not just tick like one goal, like the sustainable development goals, we're going to go for number 16, but to deliver on all seven of these wellbeing goals, which are a good rounded set of sustainability outcomes. But there's a sweet spot around it that says it's their job to maximize their contribution, not to one, but all of the goals at the same time. And what gets public sector and the businesses that supply to them off the hook is the fact that no one has got a clue what maximum looks like. Yeah, and this is really key. And I think DO is like full of stories of people who've taken things, like whether that's like big bike rides, walks, climbs, or business ideas. This isn't a theory about breaking a model. Here's the story of how I did it. So the fact that you can break models is evident in so many of the stories that DO. And what occurs to me and what gives me most hope is that basically nobody knows how much cool shit is out there and is what's possible like right now. And Steve Evans, who spoke at DO, a good friend of mine, talked about the way that 80% of the solutions to our sustainability challenges are already available for sale today on someone else's supermarket shelf. We just don't know the shops there. And so if when we're talking together with experts in this space and they're going to tried that in these 16 different ways, no, didn't work, you kind of go, Jesus, we are screwed. But when the fact that the farmers have never even had the first conversation with health boards about saying, I wonder if there's a connection between nutrition and mental health, or mental health and access to farmland to spend time in quiet and nature, or whatever, you kind of go, oh my word, there is just so much abundance of possibility in the conversations that haven't even started yet, let alone be explored fully to work out what's the possibility at that intersect of our genius. And like a tiny example of that in the world of education, and anyone who's listening who wants to get engaged in this, definitely get in touch. So our goal at TYF is to give young people an unshakable confidence in their ability to bend the arc of the future. So they've changed it more times by the time they reach the world of work, that anyone who says, oh, sorry, Gav, it's a lovely idea, but it can't be done. That any time that someone challenges saying it can't be done, the criticism will wash off their back because they've already made more change happen for real than the first people they meet who tell them it can't be done. And that's by taking real world challenges from the world of work, dropping them perfectly made into the school curriculum around communication, manufacturing, service, whatever, to build that confidence through experience. And if we do that, those young people will transform their parents' behavior. Fellow B Corp Ella's Kitchen did this lovely research that showed that 67% of business leaders with kids had upgraded their sustainability policy at work as a consequence of conversations around the dinner table.
Totally agree. I just love what you just said. I've got kids, as I know you do, if I could give my children one gift, it would be that gift, the gift of resilience and of optimism and of persistence and of, you know, all that stuff that's kind of get worn down in today's society because everyone's conforming because of freaking social media. And
you'll have read or listened to Rob Poynton's talk about improv at DO. And one of the things that Rob talks about is the way that anything that doesn't work is still a gift.
By definition, yeah.
How do you find whatever happens to you as a gift? And I guess what gives me hope, to answer your question, is to say, to imagine what would happen if the majority of kids had learned at school how to react in a gracious way when someone says, yeah, but you'll never get that to work. And for the kids to know that that's a gift. I can really understand, Dad, why you'd say that, but actually, there's this great story from XYZ and there's a DO talk on it, whatever. So the kids can help people change their mind without them feeling bad and feeling threatened.
No isn't no. It's a request for more information, right? Or tell me a better story. And I think the way kids are with their self-confidence and they just get a knockback. I see it. I started off life as a primary school teacher, little known fact. And you just see kids often with their peers going, that's a stupid idea. And then you just see them kind of retract. And then that's it. That's done for the day, for the week. David and Claire, as you know, one of their mantras is do one thing well. Please don't take this as criticism. But when I was doing my prep for this, I was kind of going, I think you made the exception to the rule. You're not doing one thing well. You're doing a bucket load of things. I'm sure some extremely well and some maybe not so well. But you can't say that to your kids, do one thing well. Is that your belief or do you agree and disagree with the Hyatt's theory of life?
I love teasing Dave and Claire about that because, of course, they do many, many things well. Like the Do Lectures and Remember Jeans Company. And at the same time, it's kind of good to know what your kind of focus is. I suppose the two bits for me, there's a kind of the caveat is to say, rip open your heart and your eyes and look outside into the world to see what's really going on. Without judging it, just notice how radical and rapid the changes that we need to make. So really notice what's going on around us. And then I think the one thing that I try to do well is to say, if I wasn't scared and I knew that I couldn't fail, what is it that I would set out to do? And then share that action with as many people as possible who might help. And the clearer I am about that and the less fearful I am in doing it, the more change that I know I can release.
Mate, we have to stop there because you won't be able to say anything as good as that if we keep on going for the rest of the day. I love talking to you. I could talk to you all night. I hope we'll be talking to you all night soon on a hay bale.
Over a beer, that would be amazing. Watching
the flames. I remember your whole thing about flames and beauty. That's another podcast. Andy, best of luck with everything. And thank you for taking the time to talk to me today. Your .. again, will go on long after this conversation. I personally appreciate everything you've done for the Do, as I'm sure to our listeners. And yeah, please take care, stay safe. Cheers, Andy.
Thank you so much. Great to see you again. All the best. Cheers. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. I loved Andy's idea about how we can improve children's education. I really hope we can somehow make that happen. As always, please do leave me a review. Please do subscribe. Please do tell your friends about the Do Lectures .. podcast. Please do listen to some of the other ones. There's lots in the bank now. And do drop me a line, gav@thedolectures.co.uk, if you want to give me some feedback or make any suggestions or just say hi. This show was produced by George McDonough. The music was by James Morton. Please stay safe, take care, and join us next time. Thanks very much. Bye.